Well, hello again, everybody. The season is over at last, and it's taken us two or three days just to let the dust settle before we set about our post-mortem after nine and a half pretty dreadful, dismal months. But we're not going to be all dismal and too morose about it, because what's happened has happened. The past is behind us. The future could well replicate the past, but hopefully Spurs and the hierarchy will learn from the past few months and make sure that this glorious summer leads to a brighter future. I'm Marcus Buckland. Joining me, as always, on the Tottenham Way, Tom Barkley of The Sun, Tom Allnut of The Times, and Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard. And our plan is to essentially run through the highlights of last season, which won't take long, the lowlights, which could take quite some time, our best players, again, a brief chat, our worst players, a few to cipher through, biggest surprise, biggest disappointment, reasons for optimism for next season, where did it all go wrong, who's to blame, and I think we also have to pay tribute to Harry Kane, who, despite everything else that happened around him, scored 30 Premier League goals, which is quite extraordinary. Dan, I'm going to start with you. You were at Leeds for what, actually, on paper is a fantastic result, 4-1. But of course, because of what Aston Villa did against Brighton, it counted for nothing. Did that performance give you any optimism for the season ahead?
Hi, Marcus. There were definitely a few bright points. Namely, Porro, Kulusevski was fairly sharp. And it was another little reminder, of which there have been far too few, that there is talent beyond Kane. But I think it was a strange game in that Leeds were down at kickoff and then they were sort of down when Kane scored in 7 minutes. So I was expecting a really tense afternoon of kind of highs and lows, and it was curiously kind of lacking tension or jeopardy. And that kind of translates onto the pitch. The players of Leeds, I should say, sort of as though they knew they were down. And obviously, when they got back in the game, Spurs went up straight up the other end and scored. So there was kind of very little jeopardy. And I think the fact that sort of given up was by Lucas scoring that late goal, where he just kind of ran through a load of statues, which was a great moment for him. But it was symptomatic of the fact that Leeds are kind of thrown in the towel from that point and from pretty early on. I suppose you could say it sort of summed up really in that it was fairly middling, apart from Kane, who was outstanding.
I'm intrigued to know what the two Toms have to say about this. I started to feel like I was the only Spurs fan that was absolutely gutted on Sunday when we didn't qualify for the Europa Conference League. For me, particularly with regard to Harry Kane, I felt it was essential that we got into that competition to have a real, genuine chance of winning a trophy under a new manager next season. And the fact that we didn't, the fact that we're not going to have European football for the first time in, what is it, a decade, was to me a hammer blow. I don't think it was to a lot of other people. But Tom, how would you assess that?
You're a romantic, Marcus, that's the thing. You know, you like the thrill of the trophy, you're old school. These days, it's not about that. It's all about the Premier League race for the top four. I mean, I do think I've always been quite keen on Spurs qualifying for the Europa League. And I don't know if it's inconsistent then to kind of say that actually I think there is quite a big gulf between the merit of qualifying for the Europa League and the merit of qualifying for the Conference League. I just think the kind of prestige of the Europa League and the prize of getting into the Champions League for it, even the finances are still quite significantly more than the Conference League. I just think the opposition you come up against in the Conference League and the reward for what you actually get for winning it, I have to say, I think it's really marginal, sort of whether or not it was a good thing to get in it. I don't think it would be swaying Harry Kane's future either one way or the other. I really don't. And I do think that, you know, with the nature of the Premier League next season, now that we've really got a kind of a top six, top seven, even if you throw Villa in, a possible kind of top eight, all kind of going for the top four, I do think that not having a European competition could be quite a significant advantage in that, you know. And we've seen this season Arsenal, okay, they were in the Europa League, but they went out of the Cups very early. They went out of the Europa in the last 16. And I think that did help them. It really did help them kind of keep a very core, tight-knit group going in the Premier League. And as we see this kind of competition hot up for the top four in the Premier League, I actually think it could be quite a big benefit not to be in that competition next season. I mean, let's see. Obviously, I mean, I'm never really a fan of Spurs kind of being up for exiting competitions. We know how much they need a trophy, how much they need a cup run. But I do think that the Conference League is a slight step below all the other ones.
Yes, just to add to Tom's point, I mean, I think I don't think it would put off any managers either, really, for the points that Tom's just made, really. I think they'll go into next season in a better position of not having to play Thursday, Sunday, worry about the cram fixture list, some of the trips they'd have to make. And they'll look at teams like Newcastle this season in particular. I know they made the League Cup final, but they went out very early at the FA Cup. Obviously, no European football. And you can sort of get a real momentum behind you. And with the squad that Tottenham have, which obviously needs to be trimmed quite a lot with no European football, given all the players that are out on loan and the fact they're looking to bring in new players. I'm coming around to the thinking that it might be more of an advantage. I mean, with Kane, he said a few weeks ago to us, as we talked about before, that he wouldn't turn his nose up at it because it gives an opportunity to win a trophy. But I almost feel like if he really believes that, he's almost in this unique situation where he is so desperate to win a trophy if he's still going to be here. Whereas for most people who don't have that baggage of being at the club for so long, never having won any silverware or a new manager coming into it, they don't really have that. And apart from if you go on and win it, and you look at what that's done for Roma and how they've kicked on since and how Jose Mourinho has been taken into the Roma fans' hearts as a result, and West Ham, if they go on and win it too, I don't really see there being that much upside. So whilst it would have been disappointing on the day to have won, and that was the target they were going for on the day, and to not come up with it, not to end up with it, would have been disappointing. In the long run, I don't think it's much of a miss.
Good. I actually feel a bit better having heard both of you mentioned that. I was in the slumbers, the depths of despair. But yeah, that's a good point. We can just focus from week to week on how to lose the next game.
I have a question for Dan. I was wondering what he thought about Lucas Moura's goal, because on telly it kind of looked like a wonder goal, obviously, but I couldn't decide whether this was sort of Maradona take two or whether it was just really, really bad Leeds defending. I don't know how you felt about it watching it live.
Yeah, I think I touched on it in my first answer. I think it was a bit of both, but more really bad Leeds, a Leeds side who literally seconds from being confirmed as a Championship club again, and who had just kind of given up, sort of mentally and exhausted at the end of a long season. But I mean, nonetheless, you know, he had to go for it, and that's kind of classic Lucas, wasn't it? He said after the Brentford game that he hadn't decided what he was going to and he would go back to Brazil and then consider his offers. But I do kind of just want him to go and play in like the Championship and just be the best player and sort of 10 dribbles per season, because it's entertaining when he does it. But I think at Premier League level, he just ends up running down too many blind alleys and pitched too savvy. But it was a nice moment, wasn't it? And the kind of perfect sign off for Lucas.
Well, that brings us on to the first of our categories, which we're going to rattle through. We will start with highlights of the season, and that moment at least ended it on a high. For my mind, I'm going to go with the equaliser at Chelsea right at the start of the season. And I remember watching that game from a hotel in New York, and Spurs got a corner. I think it was deep into stoppage time. We were 2-1 down, and I screamed at the TV. I said, "This time, come on, let's make it happen." And lo and behold, we equalised, which sparked the big tussle between Tuchel and Conte on the sidelines. At that stage, I thought this is going to be a brilliant season. Of course, I was wrong. My second highlight is actually beating Chelsea in the return fixture, because I was dreading Graham Potter actually finally putting together a magical 11 to beat Spurs. And that was a good moment. And of course, I think everybody's highlight probably has to be Harry Kane breaking Jimmy Greaves' record. So those are my nominations. I don't know where else you guys might want to go with that.
Well, I think personally, the fact that my highlight of the season actually came before the season began sort of sums up the campaign. It was the pre-season tour to South Korea was just amazing. Obviously, amazing experience to be out there. But I think there was just so much enthusiasm, excitement, anticipation of what was to come after what felt like a successful window in the transfer market, at least on paper it did. Obviously, didn't pan out that way. And all of them probably will come into the reckoning when we talk about the disappointments. Maybe not every single player, but for different reasons. But there was so much optimism at the time. I remember Conte and Son in that press conference, which was about 100 South Korean journalists there, not really asking many questions, many just wanting to be in Son's presence, it felt like at the time. And Conte striking the camera snap pose with Son, big smiles, everything seemed so positive at the time. But yeah, I mean, as regards the season, I mean, I still think that Fulham home game quite early on, which was only 2-1 as a scoreline, was maybe their best performance. So it's got to be up there. That was a really, really impressive performance there. And you sort of thought, oh, if they can kick on from here. But that was kind of the height of it, really, sadly. Apart from beating Man City at home, which obviously led, you know, Kane's winner, which was amazing from a personal point of view. But that was an impressive performance, more from a defensive perspective. But sadly, we didn't see it happen too often.
I'm racking my brains here for something that hasn't already been mentioned. Big winner against Marseille to top the group was a good moment, I thought, and a very encouraging second performance. Obviously, Kane's goal at City. There was another late winner against Bournemouth when Spurs came back from 2-0 down to win 3-2. There were just so many moments where you wondered what season would kind of spark into life, whether Spurs would kick into gear, whether it was like a turning point. The amount of times I must have written in copy, was this the moment? Was turning point? Can Spurs find some consistency from here? So there were lots of little moments that were quite enjoyable at the time, but really nothing and were significant in terms of the bigger picture. And obviously the Marseille winner, was it Højbjerg?
Højbjerg, 95th minute.
That was great, and I thought deserved for the way Spurs played in the second half. And it felt like, particularly without Conte on the sideline, that was a pretty significant show of mentality. And it, as I said, you just wondered whether these would lead to something bigger and better, and whether it would be kind of important in the season, but it just never panned out that way. I guess we'll have to include this in kind of lowlights or another category, but in terms of just things that I'll remember, and it was great to be at, I mean, Conte's rant was at Southampton was right up there. I mean, that was my most memorable moment this season by far. But I don't know whether we can say that's a kind of highlight and put it in the positive camp.
Oh. That definitely sums up the season. I should just point out here, Dan, I think your mic's playing up a little bit, so it's a bit like a crossword, but we're having to occasionally work out which three letters every now and then miss out. But that's good, because it's forcing me to listen even more closely to you than usual. But apologies if occasionally Dan's words of wisdom, or some of them, just disappear into the ether. Tom A, what can you give us?
Well, Conte's rant as well, it shouldn't be forgotten, was a sort of personal tirade against Dan at one point. He was, it was his question. I think he asked something like, what was it? Dan, like, he's off fixing his mic, but it was something like, you know, is it up to you to coach the players or something?
I asked him if his contract situation and the uncertainty of his future was a contributing factor to the players.
But he didn't let you finish
being
that question,
slugs, basically.
Yeah, brave man.
He was already interrupting you at that point and telling you that you were making excuses, alibis. So that was certainly a personal highlight for me, was seeing Dan getting taken down by Antonio. But I sort of agree. I mean, I think that sort of general period in October, November before the World Cup, and it didn't feel like it at the time, because we were all kind of wondering, can Spurs kind of keep this up? And I think we all had a sort of suspicion they probably couldn't. But if we remember, they kept on coming back and kind of winning games that they had no real right to win. I mean, you know, that victory against Leicester when they won 6-2, for example, you know, it was obviously a pretty thrilling game. Son came off the bench and scored a hat-trick, which was a really nice moment. But as Dan said, it was all kind of like, it was filled with this sort of, is this the moment when, you know, Son is going to suddenly start playing better? Are Spurs suddenly going to be a more stable team? And it never quite happened. I mean, remember the 4-3 game against Leeds, for example, when they came back and Bentancur scored two late goals. It was a great match. It was a kind of thrilling game, but it was just sort of all laced with this sort of concern that actually Tottenham can't keep playing like this. And that kind of was how it played out in the end. You know, I mean, there were two or three quite, you know, thrilling games in that regard, in that kind of era, in that period. And they went into the World Cup, of course, you know, in fourth position, look in all the cups, you know, into the knockout stage of the Champions League. And I wouldn't say it was a highlight, but it, in that kind of period of the season, there was at least some hope. You know, it was sort of teetering on the brink. You know, this could go either way at this moment. It's either going to unravel and Conte is going to blow up, or, you know, Spurs are actually going to find some consistency and maybe push on into the second half of the season. And we all know which way it went. But there was a time when this season felt like there was a possibility it could be a success. It just, you know, all went south very, very quickly.
Just a word on that was mentioned, Højbjerg. And I do wonder if in all the misery of this season, we have slightly devalued getting out of the group in the Champions League stage. I don't know, really. Was it an easy group or not? Sure, they did top it. I mean, this is the thing with European football, cup competitions, is as soon as you go out, you sort of forget the journey that got you there, even if you make the semi-final, the FA Cup, whatever it is. And maybe we are not giving them quite enough credit for that. I mean, whilst on paper, at least, we probably thought that Tottenham had the strongest team and the strongest manager than those other three teams. I mean, I had all those away games. I don't know if you guys did all of them, but the atmospheres at all three of those teams, Sporting Lisbon, Eintracht Frankfurt and Marseille, were really hostile. They're not easy games for any team to sort of perform in. And whilst actually thinking about it, they did go and lose at Sporting. They drew up Frankfurt and just about won at Marseille. It was not like they actually did that well, thinking about it, in those games. But ultimately, they got out of that group. So I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to be a bit more, not balanced, but not try and be too down on everything. But maybe it was a bit better, at least on the Champions League front. But then again, you think of Milan and how that all panned out, so maybe not.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the flip side of that is you look at the knockout stages and you kind of think Spurs could have been in the final, you know, like not even a sort of really good Tottenham team, but just a sort of 7 out of 10 playing fairly well with Harry Kane in the team, Tottenham team, could have got to the final. They could have beaten a very average AC Milan. Okay, they then beat Napoli, who are, you know, really concentrating on Serie A at that point. They then would have had a semi-final against an Inter Milan team who, in my opinion, are pretty beatable. And, you know, we'd have a final now against Manchester City, who Tottenham always beat. So it could have been a lot better.
Oh, it could. A lot better. Which brings us on to the low lights. There is one, for me, one moment where I knew it was coming too, because we've seen it before. I really hope we don't see it again. But when we went to Sheffield United for that FA Cup tie, I feared the worst, especially when I saw the starting 11. And as that game developed, there was an air of inevitability for me that we were going to concede. And I think that was the moment where it all went completely pear-shaped. I mean, there are other areas I'm sure you'll mention, but would you agree that was a particularly depressing evening, mainly because we've been there before on so many occasions?
Yeah, I mean, that is the obvious place to start. I was there at Bramall Lane. It was just really, there's nothing positive to say about that game and what a missed opportunity it was. And the decision to rest Kane obviously hasn't aged well at all, although some people pointed out, I think he played against Middlesbrough the year before and that didn't work there either. So it's not, I don't think you can solely put it on that, but it's more the, I guess, perceived arrogance of thinking you're going to get through a game like that by not playing your strongest team. I think sometimes people sort of underestimate how just changing a few key players can upset the balance of a team when they're going away to a team that ultimately got promoted to the Premier League as well. Although then they rested a whole bunch of players as well. So there really are no excuses from Spurs' point of view. But that was the cliche beginning of the end, wasn't it? Well, I was all three of those games. So it started off with Sheffield United on the Wednesday. Then they went to Wolves and lost 1-0. They were a bit better there, and they had their chances. I think Porro hit the bar with a free kick, but they lost it ultimately. And then the Milan game, which I might argue was even more of a disappointment, because they were at home. They managed to get through the first leg. All right, they were 1-0 down, but given that they had the injury problems and had Sarr and Skip playing in midfield, it could have been worse, given there were a couple of late chances, weren't there, in Milan, which they didn't concede. And it's the fact that they had sort of one or two shots throughout the match and really didn't give it a go. And I think when we look back at Conte, who really, as proven from that rant with Dan and how much he got irked by that particular question, didn't seem to ever really take his part of the responsibility, in my opinion, for what had gone wrong. That game was the biggest criticism you could label at him for not giving it more of a go in that match. I mean, maybe I'm being completely out of my depth from a tactical point of view, not being a manager, to think that they could have gone for it a bit more in that game. But that's the way I saw it. And so in a way, maybe that was even more disappointing, given that the FA Cup wasn't as high a priority as the Champions League.
I mean, just on the FA Cup, Kane said a couple of weeks later, it was a dagger hearts going out against United. So I think the squad felt that that was big, big moment in this as well. And as you said, Marcus, the beginning of the end, really. And I tend to agree with Tom on Milan, not laying a glove at home and bringing on Sanchez at the end just almost felt like the moment Conte threw in the and sort of stopped caring. I mean, I think you can make a case that it was before that, but that was certainly a really low moment where I just felt it obviously over for him. I do think the nadir, though, was Newcastle. I think there's never been a worse start to a game by Premier League, and they made for many, many years. You know, the first 21 minutes was farcically bad, and it was almost like a combination of all the poor decisions the club has made from the top down over the last 4 years. You know, everything, you know, all the chickens coming home to roost, one nightmare spell on the pitch. So even though the season almost felt like it was drifting toward nothingness at that point, I still think that was the kind of lowest moment for fans and players and the club as a whole.
It was almost like the Newcastle game, I think, was the moment when like Tottenham's crisis became more than a team crisis, is when it became like a club crisis. You know, like I think it's easy to forget now that for most of the season, we were kind of wondering about how Spurs might create more chances, you know, how to get Son back into form, how to play the best, you know, who is the best wing backs, you know, and all these things seem quite kind of small and insignificant now. But actually, those were the kind of worries of the first half of the season. And then post Newcastle, it was like, what is Tottenham? You know, what is the culture of the club? What is Daniel Levy doing? Why is there not a manager? Why is there not a sporting director? What's the direction here? You know, that was when everything became much more existential. So I agree with Dan. I mean that Newcastle game was arguably what the sort of, it's hard to think of a worse moment in the last 20 years, you know, in terms of Spurs. I mean, I personally also look back at the Arsenal game when they played at home. And although it was a match that you wouldn't really expect Tottenham to win, I remember watching it live there and just sort of thinking, how did these two clubs swap places so dramatically, so quickly? You know, Tottenham were playing at home in a North London derby and they didn't even really take part in that match. Arsenal basically switched off after about an hour, knew they had the victory sewn up. It was as if they were playing against a championship team, you know, and okay, it wasn't 6-1 against Newcastle. It wasn't losing to Sheffield United. But if there was a match that really struck me that of the kind of trajectories of these two clubs and how poor Tottenham have been in the last couple of years, that was the one, you know, and that really summed up the season. I do think as well the Arsenal brilliance this season has sort of lingered in the air over Spurs the whole year. It's sort of been there as a kind of a ongoing evidence of what Spurs have done wrong and what they could be doing if they were better run.
Well, thank God they choked towards the end of the season. That's all I can say. That actually, going back to the highlights, that's probably it, isn't it? Arsenal blowing whatever 10-point lead with a couple of months of the season to go. Right, okay, highlights and lowlights. Best players, worst players. Well, we're all going to say Harry Kane. My only other selection for a best player, certainly most improved player by a distance, and we missed him towards the end of the season when he was injured, Emerson Royal. I thought he was an absolute revelation. Worst players for me, well, I hate to be too negative, but you could list a whole host. I've gone with two. Sessegnon, because he really frustrates me. A, because he's often injured, and that's not necessarily his fault. But B, when he's on the pitch, to me, he's just so negative, so lacking in belief, which is perhaps a managerial coaching issue as much as anything else. But I've just been so disappointed by his overall contribution. And at the back, I'm afraid that Eric Dier has obviously come in for a lot of criticism, and there I go, but I'm not going to be any more negative than that.
Kane, obviously, for best player. A nod to Bentancur. I thought he was who you were going to say there when you said we missed him toward the end of the season when he was injured. I thought he was great. He's barely played since the World Cup, really, because he came back from Qatar with an injury. So he did get back in the team for a few weeks, but then obviously did his ACL. But such a shame, because I thought before the World Cup, he was really developing into this kind of all-round, you know, elite midfielder. You know, the one he didn't have when he came to Spurs and didn't do much of in Italy was score goals. And he'd got 5 goals maybe in the league, I think, in the first season, which is a decent return. So he was kind of on track for potentially hitting double figures this year had he not been injured. So I think a nod to Bentancur. And maybe to go back to what Tom Barkley was saying, you know, Højbjerg had that big moment in Marseille, and I know he frustrates a lot of fans, but I think pretty consistent. He's had some stinkers, like everyone really, apart from Kane. But he has been there. He's played a lot of football, and I think he deserves a bit of credit. But yeah, it's pretty slim picking in terms of worst player. I think look at Richarlison, given the kind of the spend on him. One league goal is obviously an absolute awful return on £60 million. I know there have been sort of mitigating factors like injury and a lack of rhythm, but he's been really disappointing. And again, not so much his fault, but kind of expectation versus reality. I think Bissouma has only just showing what he can do in the last couple of games under Mason, and was basically anonymous for the whole year.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dan's point about Højbjerg is fair, because earlier in the season, it wasn't just that goal at Marseille. I seem to remember quite a few games where his goals were actually quite useful, and he was a really dependable midfielder. I also thought you were going to talk about Bentancur as well, Marcus. And I think if there's one success story from a player development point of view under Conte, it would be him. Conte often talked about how difficult it would be for any midfielder to play in his midfield too. And I think we saw that by the way Bissouma struggled before he then got injured. But Bentancur seems to be almost like the prototype to play in that position in a Conte midfield too, along with probably N'Golo Kante. Just, he's such a graceful player, and they really, really missed him. After that, obviously Kane. And you know how much I like Emerson. I guess finally, maybe Pedro Porro deserves a bit of a shout out, not for his defensive side of the game, but he has shown what an asset he can be going forward. And I think whoever gets the job going for next season has a bit of a headache to work out how to get the best out of him, because he looks like he's got the talent that he's worth starting and could be, as I said, a real asset for the team. But unless he can improve his defensive side of the game quickly, it might have to be almost in a winger position or a wing back position. From the downside, I mean, where do you start? All those guys you've mentioned already are very fair. Just to throw into the mix, we haven't actually talked about Sun Heung-min. And he's just such a disappointment. It's not like he's been the worst player by any stretch, but from where he's come last season and hoping he would kick on from there, that really hasn't happened. So even though I'll probably get a load of abuse for saying it, I do think he's got to be almost, if not prime suspect number one, then he's got to be up there. And then along with his other number 10, as Conte used to put it, Dejan Kulusevski's had a pretty dreadful season, given where, again, he played last season, how well he was doing. So those two guys, along with many others. And I also think Christian Romero has been poor for what a player we all think. I'm not sure if I completely concurred on that episode where we talked about him in depth, but he is clearly a good player when he's playing well, and it hasn't happened nowhere near often enough.
I guess just in the middle of the section, I would jump in to say that when this many players play badly, it is really symptomatic of something bigger, isn't it? So I suppose we should talk at some point about Conte and kind of how much blame rests at his door. Because I do think when you could literally name almost any member of the squad as having a disappointing season or underwhelming except Kane, it points to a kind of bigger problem than just individual form and players.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I don't really have anything to add. I sort of had a couple of players, but I think everyone's kind of mentioned them. I do think Kulusevski is a good shout from Tom Barkley. I mean, I just think he hasn't been Spurs' worst player than by a long shot. But in terms of sort of disappointment, I mean, I remember writing a piece during the World Cup saying how important Kulusevski could be in the second half of Tottenham's season, having not played in Qatar. and having not really sort of delivered to his full potential in the first half of the season, but it just never happened, you know. And I think from what we expect of him, he didn't deliver. Yes, Son definitely really. I mean, it's incredible to think now he was a top scorer last season, right? That was last season, and he was Golden Boot. I mean, that's it's just unthinkable now. And all the others. I mean, I agree, Pedro Porro. I think just in the last few weeks, I think we've seen him getting better and better, you know, and that to see a trajectory of a player at Spurs going up rather than down sort of stands out. So I do think in the last two or three weeks, he just looks like someone who's maybe adjusting to the Premier League, and that could be a real plus for Spurs next season.
The reason I didn't mention Bentancur amongst the best players is because I've got him in our next category, biggest disappointment, and not the way he was playing. The biggest disappointment for me was when he got injured, because I think we all realised how important he was to the team. And at that moment, I thought, we're not exactly blessed with that type of player anyway. If he's out for the season, we're in trouble. So that was a huge disappointment for me. And likewise, the reason I didn't mention Richarlison as one of the worst players is, again, because every time he came on, I kept thinking, yeah, this is going to be the week. And there is still something about Richarlison that I like, but I was becoming more and more frustrated with him. Equally, I understand, as Dan mentioned, there was a lack of rhythm for him in terms of the fact that he didn't play a lot of games, certainly didn't start a lot of games. So he did find it difficult, but that was a huge disappointment for me. And just to echo what Tom said, Son, obviously, I still love the guy to bits and he's trying. But yeah, the disappointment that he couldn't recapture that extraordinary form of the year before was obviously a little bit of a dagger blow. So those are my three biggest disappointments, but I probably could sit here for another couple of hours and tell you about plenty of other ones. In fact, I could sit here for a week and tell you about 45 years of supporting Spurs disappointments, but you probably don't want that right now, guys, do you?
You can spare us that, Marcus, I think. I'm going to go for Perisic as my disappointment. Just think, he arrived as this kind of highly experienced winner, the perfect Conte player, you know, the man to make Conte's system tick, the man who won it all before under Conte, and, you know, just looked like such a smart bit of business. And also he kind of represented something bigger as well, in a way. He kind of represented this idea that the club was prepared to change their transfer strategy and really go all in on Conte and build his winning machine. I mean, I think he's scored once. He's got a lot of assists, but they're mainly set pieces, which he was great at, by the way. You know, taking corners and free kicks with either foot, you know, remains a great skill, and I really enjoyed watching that. But he just hasn't been anywhere near what we expect him to be, I think. And I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, it's just my opinion and rather than information, if, you know, he left this summer, and he felt like such a Conte man. And I think his stay, you know, his 1 year stay, if it turns out to be that, would be kind of very, very unmemorable. There just weren't a lot of moments or even matches where he kind of stood out.
Yeah, I think the phrase up to speed with Perisic is really apt. He has never really seemed like he's been up to the pace of the game in the Premier League. And I was reading some Anthony Gordon quotes today, where he was talking about, since moving to Newcastle, he feels like he hasn't been fit enough for that, the way the Newcastle team play. And that's a young, sort of speedy, you don't think of him as a player who would struggle with the pace or the physicality of that particular team, not like Tottenham playing the same way as Newcastle, but that sort of just shows you just how hard and difficult it can be in the Premier League. And I think Perisic, we all thought, as Dan pointed out, he might be the perfect fit, but it just doesn't really seem like he's suited to the Premier League at this stage in his career. I mean, there are lots of disappointments, but I mean, I'm rather than going for a specific player, because we might get in sort of repetitive sort of area here talking about individuals. I just think the transfer business overall, I remember being really excited about the signings they were making. I think they were really quite clever. We just mentioned Perisic, and on paper looked like the man to make this team tick, as Dan said. Richarlison seemed like a sensible signing, because he can play through the middle, can play on both sides. It's very difficult to sign a striker who's going to be happy to back up to Harry Kane, but he could fit in everywhere. It just hasn't worked. Bissouma, I've gone on about how what a good player he was at Brighton so many times. And I still think, you know, you can't write off a lot of these players, but you just go through the list. I mean, Jed Spence never even got a chance, did he? I mean, it's so underwhelming from where we sort of hoped they would be off the back of that. And then just finally, as it's not a personal disappointment, but I wonder how disappointed Ryan Mason must be at this point for not being given the reins on interim basis from the beginning after Conte got sacked, because I wasn't at the Leeds game. I've seen the highlights, and obviously Leeds are in absolute dire straits, so how much you can glean from that, I don't know. But the Brentford game I was there for, I know the second half was a disaster and they lost the match, but the first half, as Tom and I were saying after that game, was about as exciting as I can remember it this year at Spurs. And it just makes you think, if he had a bit longer to work with these guys, and if he'd been there from the beginning after Conte, he might genuinely have put himself into a position where he could be a genuine contender for this job. Not to rule him out completely, but I think most of us are thinking it's probably unlikely. So, yeah, I wonder how disappointed he would be right now with that decision.
Pochettino not being hired and Pochettino being hired by Chelsea, I think, has to be pretty high up there for off the pitch disappointments. Such an open goal for Spurs and Daniel Levy, just to kind of give a cheap and easy morale boost to the whole club with 2 or 3 months to go. And what might have been, you know, what might have been if they'd done that, I don't know. I mean, maybe it wouldn't have happened. Maybe Spurs still would have kept unravelling, you know. I mean, neither Stellini nor Mason have been able to turn this team around, but I suspect that Pochettino's return in February or March, whenever it was, might have been not only the story of the season, but it might have saved Tottenham's season as well. So not only did they pass that up, but also pass them into Chelsea's hands. I think let's see how long the disappointment continues to fester.
I do have to say on that subject, I've been surprised just by... Well, I shouldn't be surprised on social media with what you read, but I can't believe how many Spurs fans are now totally dissing Pochettino because he's gone to Chelsea. And a lot of them, I think, are conveniently forgetting, well, one of our all-time greats, Glenn Hoddle, was at Chelsea as a player manager years ago. No one seems to have a problem with that. And I really don't personally, because we all know, well, we all think anyway, that Poch was waiting for the phone to ring and it didn't. And we've touched on this before, guys, but he's got to get a job. There aren't that many jobs out there that are going to suit his requirements at this stage. I just don't have a problem with him. And I hope most Spurs fans will be sensible about that, because to try and compare him with Sol Campbell, for example, to me is absolute madness.
I wonder if that's something, I don't know what the other guys think, but I wonder if this is a kind of an example of when sort of Twitter fans are slightly different to the fans in the stands. I don't know. Let's see. My general kind of sense of speaking to Spurs fans and listening to them on the train and the buses and things around the stadium is that there isn't a lot of hatred for Pochettino going to Chelsea. It's more kind of frustration with Levy and the board and the club and the direction. And it's sort of almost a little bit similar in the tone to Harry Kane. You know, I mean, I'm not saying Harry Kane goes to Chelsea, but I suspect if and when Harry leaves, the frustration is not at Kane deciding finally to give up with Spurs. It's on Spurs not making an offer that's good enough to him, you know. And I think that's the way it goes. But let's see. I mean, I do think it depends a little bit on how it plays out with Pochettino and Chelsea. If he fails, then all the better. You know, he comes back to Tottenham in 2 or 3 years. If he does very well, you know, and he wins lots of trophies there, then he could quite quickly become a bit less of a Tottenham icon, I would imagine.
Okay, well, we'll come on to Harry Kane in a moment. That's the last of our sections, his great season, and then we'll just get a quick cross-section as to whether you think that was his last ever game in Spurs colours. We've got to find some reasons for optimism. And for me, well, obviously, we're going to appoint a new manager, so I'm optimistic that this time, miraculously, they get it right. You mentioned Porro, I think all of you, actually, and there was enough from him towards the end of the season to make me feel that he could be a real positive factor next season. I'm really hoping that Dan Juma is going to stay. You might know more about that. I think that was one of the frustrations, not biggest disappointments, but a real frustration for me, that was that Dan Juma hardly got a kick until the last couple of games of the season. Bentancur's going to come back. Let's hope he's fully fit again. And Bissouma as well. There have been some signs, haven't there, in the last couple of games, that if he's fit and gets a really good pre-season under his belt, we might see the Bissouma that I know you, Tom Barkley, were so impressed about, enamoured with when he was doing his stuff in Brighton colours.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of gets to the heart of why there are reasons to be optimistic, is that these players, a lot of them haven't really shown anywhere near what they're capable of, or what they should be capable of in terms of the new signings. Maybe we're sort of thinking Perisic, maybe he just doesn't really fit very well at the age he is. But Richarlison obviously can do better than he has done this season, and Bissouma as well. And I do think there are, as you say, there have been moments in the last few games that have hinted at his quality. So if someone can really get that the best out of him on that front, then that is reason to be very optimistic. I guess the big caveat to all that is Harry Kane's future. And as if in the worst case scenario he were to leave this summer, then suddenly finishing eighth in the Premier League might not look as terrible, because it might be because the competition is so fierce. And you look at the squad after that, I mean, this season's has shown how dependent they are on him, that it could actually get worse, which is kind of going against what I originally thought when I thought of this question, that things can only get better. But let's stay positive and hope that he will stay this summer. I think we've said all along that we think that's probably most likely. If he is to leave, it's probably going to be on a free transfer next summer. So, yeah, back to my original point, to talk myself around it. I think all these players can improve from where they are, and that with the right kind of manager, a manager who wants to be there, a manager who focuses on improving players, means that they should be in a much better position next season.
Yeah, I think to pick up on that, there's actually a lot of quality young players in the squad. If you consider Spence, Udogie, Sarr, Skip, Kulusevski, Porro, I think they're all 23 or under. And then there's a kind of raft of players who are sort of 24 to 27, like Bentancur, Romero, Emerson Royale. I haven't mentioned Sessegnon yet. I thought someone would say that, but there's actually a nucleus of a good young squad there, I think, and it's easy to forget that given how dreadful this season has been. Yes, the squad's kind of imbalanced. Yes, it needs a lot of work. Yes, there are like glaring problem areas like goalkeeper and centre half, but I think there is the basis of a promising group, and it's been really easy to overlook that at times this season. The right manager coming in who wants to work with young players and improve them will have a lot of raw material there. And I think that is a big reason for optimism if the club can make some canny additions this summer and offload some of the deadwood, which is obviously a big if.
Tom A, on several occasions this season, you have kind of saved me because you're good at being positive. I remember when Spurs was still in the mix for everything, you were saying, you know, a couple of results here and there, we could have a really good end to the season. Now, that positivity proved to be a little unwise with the benefit of hindsight, but it was appreciated at the time. Give us some more reasons to feel a little warm glow in the heart as we prepare to lie in the sun for a couple of months.
You're welcome, Marcus. You're very welcome. I sort of think, basically, I sort of remember the season when Harry Redknapp took over at Spurs, and everyone kind of thought that squad was completely imbalanced, that they'd bought all these duds, and that people like, who was this Luka Modric who they'd signed, you know, who was nowhere near physical enough for the Premier League, you know, couldn't play central midfield and had to be played out in the left wing. And they had other players like Gareth Bale, you know, who every time he played, they kept on losing, and left back, you know, this sort of cursed Gareth Bale, who was this kid they signed from Southampton. And quite quickly, you realise that actually under a manager who can make the players sort of believe in themselves again, who can restore their confidence, who can make them play in a more fluid and attacking way, quite quickly, these players who everyone wrote off and said, you know, the problem is the players, to quote Conte, actually, the problem wasn't the players. The problem was the culture. The problem was the coach. The problem was that the fans weren't behind the team. And things can turn around very quickly. Like, you look at Aston Villa, for example. Everyone thought, this is a club who are going to be in a relegation battle. You know, a terrible team, have signed badly, yada, yada, yada. And yet they bring in a really good coach, give them a month-long break at the World Cup to prepare properly, and they finish in seventh place. Things can change very quickly. And I really think that Tottenham have got some raw materials there. They're under the right coach, and it's a big asterisk because we don't know who that right coach is going to be at the moment, but under the right coach could suddenly start playing a lot better. I think they've, you know, this is a squad who have been playing 2 points out of 10 below where they should be this season all the way through. and it will only take a coach to make them play par, only to play 6 or 7 out of 10, you'll see an improvement. And if you can get a coach in who can make them start playing 2 or 3 points above their station, like a good coach should, then this Tottenham team can be right back in the mix next season.
In which case, when we come to our penultimate section, who is to blame? And I think most Spurs fans, if you went up to them in the street, would immediately say, well, it's Daniel Levy. But based on what you guys have referred to over the past half an hour or so, is Antonio Conte ultimately the man who holds responsibility for what did not happen in the end this season? Dan?
I mean, I think it is important to say that it's a combination of various things. And we don't have to say it's down to Conte or it's down to Levy or it's down to the players. It's a mixture of all of the above, really. But I do think any suggestion that Conte has kind of somehow been vindicated by what's happened in the last few weeks since he was sacked is nonsense, really. You know, from the off, and I don't know if we're going to come to this, but you said at the start, you know, where did it all go wrong? And I was having a think about that question, and you know, it almost feels to me like it's kind of been going wrong since the very start. I mean, I remember there was a lot of optimism, as Tom Barkley said, over the summer and at the start of the season, and it began with that big win over Southampton. But I think even before that game, Conte had been asked about the new signings and just appeared very kind of negative about it, and you know, had basically come out in his first press conference of the season and said that Spurs were still miles away from challenging, and it was easy not to pay too much attention to that at the time, but it just kind of pointed to the fact that it felt like he'd already, at least in part, sort of checked out and wasn't really feeling good about the job and kind of on the same page as the club. And it's just been downhill from there, really. I think a big part of the responsibility for how this season has gone rests with him. Obviously, you can look at the backing the club gave him, and they didn't go all in, and that was a problem because you have to go all in with a coach like Conte. But I also think he was given a lot of good quality players. As I said, he had a lot to work with, and he massively, massively underwhelmed. People will say Spurs were fourth when he was sacked, but I think that was a false position, really. I mean, not least because teams around them had games in hand. They'd never played well under him this season. There were a couple of performances that were encouraging, and the rest were distinctly underwhelming. So, yes, I think Conte deserves a really significant portion of the blame for how this campaign panned out.
That point about being in a false position is an interesting one, because that's literally what Ryan Mason said in his final press conference, might well be his final press conference, for a pre-match ahead of the Leeds match. He was speaking very candidly about a lot of things, and he was asked about that, because I think we're not even third rather than fourth, or either way, they're in the Champions League spots when Conte left. And he said it's a false position. The points you made, you know, the teams had games in hand, but he also made quite a few pointed comments, which he's kind of said after the Brentford game as well, about the idea of the club needing to commit to a way forward and be consistent with it and commit to it, but also to have people, staff and players who are committed to that as well. And he reiterated that to a lot more in that press conference ahead of the Leeds match. And it felt like it was a message towards the players, but it also, to my mind, it felt like a message towards the previous manager, who, of course, remember, he was the first team coach under. So that comes back to this idea that, as Dan said, that he'd been checked out, not really, really wanted to be there. You know, we remember being at Norwich the final day of last season, where they managed to land the Champions League football qualification, and he still wouldn't commit his future. And that kind of set the tone. And no, it's almost like when he kicked off so much at Dan personally in that press conference, we started shouting off the back of your question about commitment, which was, yeah, a great moment for us. I mean, maybe it just sort of touched a nerve, because it did, to be honest, that's kind of how it felt. How could it not have some sort of impact? But then you got to look at it and you think, well, you look at the way the players have collapsed ever since in quite a few matches, that not vindicated, but maybe he had a point. So the players are definitely culpable as well. And then when it comes to the ownership and Daniel Levy, they're the ones who picked Antonio Conte in the first place, which, whilst it paid off last season, if you knew he was going to be this kind of manager who needed you know, infinite backing, which you weren't going to be able to give financially, or you weren't planning on doing that. And he was also someone who was very combustible and always likely to blow up. I mean, you talk about surprise of the season, the least surprising thing was that happening, because they just, you know, that's what happens with Conte. Then you've also got to take some blame for that as well. So whilst it's a boring answer to say all of the above, it definitely is all of the above.
I guess you look at it now and you kind of think that so much of Conte's tenure was sort of, it was sort of built on that surge they had in the second half of last season. Because actually, you look at last season, I'm talking about two seasons ago now, you know, Spurs weren't brilliant, you know, in that season. We had, you know, this was the Burnley game where he was kind of saying he wanted to possibly leave. Am I good enough to do this job kind of thing? It was just a kind of like a last sprint, and combined with Arsenal sort of falling away, that kind of got them into fourth. And so much of that kind of optimism, I think, sustained Conte right through the summer, right through the kind of early first half of this season just gone. And actually, you kind of look at it now and think maybe that was the sort of exceptional period. Maybe that was the asterisk. Maybe that actually that wasn't the norm, that kind of time when they just kind of blitzed through just to sort of sneak fourth. I mean, someone at the club the other day was kind of saying it, you know, in a way, if you come into your new job every day and your boss sort of tells you how shit you are and how you're not good enough to do the job, for a while, you sort of want to prove them wrong. For a while, you know, it sort of burns the fires a bit and makes you work harder. But after a few months and after a year or so, that message kind of starts to grate. And I think that's kind of a fair summary almost, I think, of Conte's influence on the players. You know, it's like almost initially it kind of got them going, but then after a while it quite quickly grew old. And I just think, you know, it's been said before that Conte and Tottenham was never the right match, you know, and to make it the right match, Tottenham and Levy had to do things they've never done before. And I do have sympathy with their appointment of him. I think he was such a brilliant elite coach that actually, and his record was so compelling that I can understand why they thought that was something they couldn't turn down. But I think having appointed Conte, they had to behave in a way that would make Conte work. And they didn't, not with the signings they made, not with the way they allowed him to dictate his contract terms and his future, not with the way they allowed him to speak in press conferences so publicly against the kind of the club and the way the club was acting. And then in the end, the way he tore down the players as well, all of that had to be reined in earlier, you know. And I think ultimately Conte became too big almost for Tottenham. Like, he thought he was too big and he was allowed to kind of speak and rant, and it just became a thoroughly negative process all the way through the season. And in the end, it ended up where we ended up.
Well, we've got to end things up soon because we're almost out of time. But very quickly, our final section, and it's two questions, really. Was this Harry Kane's best ever season? Will it prove to be his last season at Spurs? For me, part one of that, I'd say possibly. I think the fact that he scored 30 goals in such a struggling team is another extraordinary effort. I'd also say that probably in previous seasons, he scored more important goals at more important times that led to better things for the club as a whole. So I'm not dismissing in any way his remarkable achievements, but I'd probably say that just because of the whole nature of everything else, it wasn't his best season. Is he going to stay? Well, you guys have got your ear to the ground more than that. I mean, I certainly would not blame him at all if he leaves. Obviously, the news that we've heard over the past day or so is that Daniel Levy's looking to block any move to another Premier League side. And I think we all clearly know that Kane only wants to go really to another Premier League side so he can beat the Shearer record. So my hunch there is that he will stay for one more season. But I certainly bow to all three of you in terms of that point, at least.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite his best season. It was obviously a huge achievement, as you said, to score 30 league goals in this team. But I think possibly his best season was 2021. I was just having a quick look on Wikipedia there, when he was both the top scorer and got the most assists. I think that was the year where you could comfortably say that Kane was outright the best player in the Premier League. And on that basis, you know, comfortably one of the best players in Europe that season as well. I don't think you can say that about him this season. I mean, I think you have to say Haaland's, you know, been better just based on the fact that he's scored more goals and played in such a winning machine. So I think it's been a phenomenal effort from Kane, but I think he's had better seasons where he's kind of been a more influential figure on the league as a whole and on the side. I don't think this is the last we've seen him in a Spurs shirt. My hunch is that he's much more likely to leave on a free in a year.
I agree. That's a point. I guess it depends on whether Spurs can try and convince him to sign a new contract, but that will depend on them having a massive upward trajectory next season. But I think he'll still be there come the end of the transfer window in September. Regards his season, yeah, probably feel like there were seasons gone by when you've just been completely had your breath taken away by how good he was. I do think the spectre of Erling Haaland means that we maybe have just slightly overlooked at times what he's done this season. I'd just say with this season, you know, he has dealt with that really traumatic, or had to be a traumatic incident for the World Cup for England. And the way he's bounced back from that is just truly remarkable. It really speaks to how he is just the ultimate pro who's so single-minded, which is just really impressive. And if you look at this season, I think he's only gone three times has he gone having three games for Spurs where he hasn't scored. So just a remarkable consistency. Obviously broke the record for the amount of headers in the Premier League this season. So maybe showing another side of his game there. So it's hard to think that he's been better, but it's just a feeling you get that maybe it's when in seasons gone by when Tottenham's done better, but there have been games where he's just looked unstoppable and one of the world's best players, which he clearly still is. But yeah, the numbers don't quite tell that story for me.
If you look in Europe, you take away Erling Haaland, Kane is the top scorer in the top five leagues, more than Mbappe, more than Lewandowski, more than Osimhen, more than, I mean, Benzema, whoever you want, really. I mean, this was the kind of, if it wasn't for Haaland's season for Kane, you know, in every way, if it wasn't for Haaland, I think he would have been right up there, Premier League Player of the Year. He would have been Golden Boot by a distance. And he would have got a lot more credit. I think it's been an incredible season for him. In terms of his future, I suspect he will stay, although I don't say it with that much confidence. The one possible emerging thing there is there's some suggestions of Karim Benzema. Real Madrid has a very big offer in Saudi Arabia. And I think if Madrid are on the lookout for a sort of quick fix for 2 or 3 years, then I think Kane will be right up there on their list. And that could be a foreign option, could be something that kind of suits everyone. But I still think Kane will be in a Spurs shirt next season, even if it's slightly reluctantly.
Well, there's some optimism for us. Once again, it's Tom Allnutt, just giving us that little bit of hope. Thank you, Tom from The Times, Tom Barkley from The Sun, Dan Kilpatrick from The Standard. If we were to ask Antonio Conte who's to blame for everything, obviously he would say Kilpatrick for that question that sent me over the edge at Southampton. But anyway, that's for another discussion. We're going to be back throughout the summer with some Spurs specials. Obviously, at some point, we'll know who the manager is. We'll know perhaps a bit more about Harry Kane, et cetera, et cetera. The two Toms have got some very clever ideas for podcasts as well. So stay with us. We will keep you company until it all gets going again in the middle of August. Give us a review, please, on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. We're on Twitter, Instagram, at The Tottenham Way. Just spread the message. We would appreciate that. Relax. Don't get too down in the dumps. There's always another season. From me, Marcus Buckland, and all the team, goodbye for now. And come on, you Spurs!